Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Gary Stewart with Conscious Connection. My person I'm interviewing today is Angwin St. Just. She's a PhD and specializes in trauma and family systems, also with nations and cultures. We have a lot to cover today, and we'll be delving into the diverse aspects of trauma bonds. She's written numerous books and has her own author page on Amazon.com, so let's get her on the line. Hello, Angwin. Hello, Angwin, are you there?
I am here.
Hello, wonderful. Thank you so much for doing our third show together. I'm very honored and pleased to do that because nothing makes us more conscious than understanding trauma bonds.
Indeed. This is really a very complex topic. So let's just, for this conversation, stay pretty much with the basics.
Sure.
Okay.
Okay, so what would be the first thing to alert people to? I don't know if you wanted to start with trauma in general or family systems.
No, I want to start with trauma bonds.
Yes, okay. So let's explain to our listeners what that is.
Okay. So trauma bonds are a very human response in those who have experienced and undergone overwhelming life events, and it's a coping mechanism, actually, and it's very useful in the short run. It can be a problem in the long run. So in a sense, when you're in a trauma bond, your solution eventually becomes your problem. So a trauma bond can be understood as a dynamic enmeshment with others who have been wounded in a similar manner or event.
Mm-hmm.
So these trauma bonds can form within intimate relationships wherein lies the illusion of finding a soulmate who
mm-hmm.
is in reality a wound mate.
Mm-hmm.
Or with members of a support group, a military unit, religious affiliation, political party, clan, tribe, race, or gender preference. So there's many variations on this theme, and it's a very important one. So
as I said,
the danger is that an extended enmeshment with these trauma bonds together with other survivors tends to isolate one from friends, family, and, this is important, all others who have not shared these exact same overwhelming experiences. So in trauma bonds, these bonds seriously narrow any interest for engagement or activities outside of these very intense trauma-dependent connections.
Mm-hmm.
And these bonds have the potential to fragment, disturb, and even destroy family cohesiveness and many other relationships as well. So this is important. And, you know, it can happen with social trauma as well, that an entire nation can be caught in a trauma bond, for example. After World War One, when Germany was completely defeated and humiliated after that event, it could be said that the German people pulled together in a trauma bond under Nazism to regain their power. And then they had this sense of shared destiny and distrust of all others who weren't in the same delusion. So, you know, it can be individuals, families, tribes, as I said, military units. It's very important in understanding combat trauma, Gary, because what we found, and you've seen this in Systemic Constellation as well, where the soldiers are in trauma bonds with their comrades.
Mm-hmm.
And these bonds are so strong that this isolates them from former friends and family. And to the point where the entanglement, if it involves dead comrades, can lead to survival guilt and eventually suicide. And if you look at the death rates of returning soldiers, and not just the Americans, you know, I saw the same phenomenon when I was working with Russian war veterans. They had more suicides following their tour in Afghanistan than there were actual fatalities in battle. And we're seeing this in the U.S. now with our returning soldiers. So you have the trauma bonds with the living, but also you have survival guilt if the bond includes dead comrades, and this is very, very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Do you find this also survival guilt with guilt from killing other human beings as well?
Yes, but less so.
So it would be more from their fallen comrades in a war situation.
Because
I know my father was on Omaha Beach in World War II, and all he ever talked about was that day, and I never knew what he was talking about. And he used to visit his war buddies who were with him on Omaha Beach, and they were like his best friends for the rest of his life. But ironically, he died of a terrible cancer, and he always said, "Why didn't I die that day? Why didn't I die that day?" And I never knew what he was talking about until I saw Saving Private Ryan, which Steven Spielberg, a reenactment, and I staggered out of the theater, understanding my father's whole psychology.
And you know, my father was in the Second World War as well. He was killed at Besançon in France, and his letters reflect both the concern for the killing, but also this salient question: why me? Why am I still alive while, quote, better people have been killed?
Yes.
And this is a very important part of trauma recovery. And one of the most difficult aspects of trauma recovery is that the bond that all of these people are in depends on staying traumatized. So the bond depends upon the trauma. So trauma recovery is threatening to the connection.
Right.
You see the conundrum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the ultimate catch-22.
Yeah, it really is. Because, first of all, many people don't know they're in a trauma bond. And second of all, any attempt to break the bond threatens the relationship.
Right, so they don't want to sacrifice that, so they'd rather stay in the trauma bond because that's what they know.
Well, the trauma bond feels, you know, it's a subjective experience, and it feels like destiny or soulmate or a divine inspiration or, national calling or whatever you want to call it, but
yes,
it feels like something much larger than themselves, and it's very difficult to break. Now, there's a film that was made in the 90s, I think it was, with Jeff Bridges. It was called Fearless. And this film it's a true story, actually. It's about the United Airlines Sioux City air disaster, where the plane crashed in a cornfield. And what you see with the survivors is that they're in a trauma bond, and they only want to be with each other, and they can't reconnect to their spouses, to their children, to their families, or to anyone else. They just want to be with each other. It's a brilliant film, and as I said, true story about trauma bonds. Unfortunately, there's another message in the film, which is it takes a shock to cure a shock, which is not true. That's unfortunate. However, Peter Levine and I worked with survivors from that crash, and we had a nice long visit with a pilot from that plane.
The pilot who
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, wonderful. Mm-hmm.
And he showed us pictures of the crash, and you know, it was really his expertise that kept anyone alive. When you look at the pictures, you just can't imagine that anyone would have survived that crash. It was very, very severe. But anyway, for study of trauma bonds, it's a marvelous example of that. Also, that was the point where Peter and I realized that airplane crashes are generational.
Mm-hmm.
Because in working with survivors of that crash and other crashes, we realized that most all of these clients were like third generation crash survivors. So that
wow.
was, yeah, another aspect that led, you know, another avenue of exploration about generational trauma and how could that be, you know, because
mm-hmm.
these people were passengers, not pilots.
Right.
So back to trauma bonds. This is really difficult for family members or for people who were in relationship or are in relationship to people mm-hmm. who are in trauma bonds with other people because they don't understand
mm-hmm.
what's going on and why they can't reconnect. So, you know, there's a lot of wounded feelings, a lot of feelings of rejection, and it's a problem for families. It's, and actually, you know, with war trauma, it's a huge social problem as well.
Yes, that was addressed last year's Oscar-nominated film, The Hurt Locker. That was addressed because he had come home from Iraq after being
mm-hmm.
in the specialist, and it showed him in his original life, and nothing made sense to him anymore. Now, whether
right.
it was the adrenaline rush, but he had to go back into another tour of duty to feel normal. He could not bond with his children, his wife, his family. It's one of the closing scenes. He was in a grocery store, like, "What am I doing here? This means
that's,
nothing."
That's right. That's
and
right.
It's interesting. Do you think part of the trauma bond, people that are deeply affected by that, it's the fight or flight neurotransmissions of neurochemicals that keeps them locked in on a somatic level?
I think that's one aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a spiritual dimension, too, which is the search mm-hmm. for meaning.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't want to reduce it to, you know, a cognitive dysfunction or a physiological response only. All of those things are important. But there's also this having this need to make it mean something.
Yes.
You know, something special, something important, something compelling.
Mm-hmm.
And again, trauma recovery has to be very delicate because you don't want to take away the sense of meaning.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, it's a fine line, Gary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you had mentioned, we had spoken about blind spots. Do you feel with people who have been in severe trauma that you work with that they do have a blind spot and not seeing the connection between the trauma and the trauma bond and their regular life?
Oh, for sure. So, again, here's this fine line. Because recovery means challenging the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and, yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Essentially, the relationship has to be renegotiated, and this can feel very threatening.
Mm-hmm. And have you found it's easy to work with people? Like, say you had a group and a few of the people who experienced the trauma together were in the same, either in a group setting or a private setting, that they would be able to work through it more effectively than just someone randomly on their own seeking help?
Again, there's two sides to it. The
mm-hmm.
group, the support group,
mm-hmm.
provides a very important resource that people come out of isolation, they find other people who've had the same kind of overwhelming experience. This is very comforting. And they begin to connect to other people. However, these connections over time, Gary, can
mm-hmm.
lead to narrowing of all other connections. Now,
mm.
I wrote about this in my first book, relative balance in an unstable world.
Mm-hmm.
I was working with two groups in the mountains. We were doing a pilot program for trauma recovery. One group was sexually traumatized women, and the other group were combat veterans. Now, you can imagine bringing these two groups together.
Absolutely. That.
Because, you know, there was a tremendous fear and suspicion between the men and the women for all kinds of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And the women were afraid of the men. The men didn't know what to do with the women because most of these guys were in Vietnam when they should have been at the prom. You know, they left early. They didn't have a whole lot of experience dating or didn't really, you know, the whole socialization
mm-hmm.
with the opposite sex was interrupted by the war. So, you know, the women saw the men as perpetrators. The men didn't know what to do with the women. And the men only wanted to be with the men, and the women only wanted to be with the women. And this was a very interesting summer. I wrote about it in the book, and you can read about it, how very, very gradually these two groups integrated.
Mm-hmm.
So they all came out of their trauma bonds into a much larger connection to the human condition. They began to see that this was part of a human condition, not something that only their group could understand. But
right,
this was a long process, and it was not a smooth process at all, but it worked.
And do you find that, let's say, sexual trauma bonds are more difficult because it involves intimacy in a physical way for, like, the women in that particular group or anyone who's suffered? In the news this week, there's a lot about the Roman Catholic Church and to the point of stepping down. And I just happened to be watching an HBO special, Mea Culpa, last night, that really quite graphically showed the connections between everything that all the sexual trauma that happened in the world under the Catholic Church heading right back to the Vatican. So that's something that's very pertinent right now is sexual trauma.
Not only the Vatican, you know, it's not only the Catholic religions that have abused children at all. You know, this seems to be not only Catholic, but also in the fundamentalist religions. You know, you're often finding the preacher is a pedophile, or, you know, shock stories where he's found in a brothel with underage, you know, and on and on. And also in the Orthodox Jewish communities, they've had their own scandals, and there is that scandal in Islam as well. And everybody denies it, but it's not peculiar to one religion. But with the child abuse, first of all, is the child is blamed.
Right.
There's the demand for secrecy, which is isolating. And there's the humiliation of having been a victim. And many of these kids and underage people really do believe it was their fault, particularly, and this is important, particularly if the child abuse was physical in the sense of beatings and sex and religion all mixed up together. Okay, this is a nice recipe for psychosis.
Yes.
Because, how is the child to make any sense of any of this when it's all mixed up together? So, and, you know, if the child is brave enough to report what goes on, they're very often not believed, and this adds to the trauma. And,
yes.
you know, let's not put this all on religion. I mean, how many politicians have been found running around with pedophile rings and underage this and that? And how about the sports figures? We had this whole scandal with Penn State.
Last year. Yes.
Yeah, heaven knows how many young athletes are abused by the coaches. And again, you know, another wrinkle in this is that these kids are being abused by people who are supposed to be protecting them. So what you get is a huge, huge breach of trust.
Yes, yes, and it's even hitting the Boy Scouts this week as well. So it's quite
interesting
how pervasive it is in all organizations. But do you think in cases like this it really becomes more about power? Because it seems like everyone is in a position of power and the lack of accountability, whether it's any kind of abuse whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember that at some point a reporter asked Bill Clinton, "Why did you do what you did?" And he said, "Because I could."
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Which is really chilling.
Yeah. But
the chilling
state. There's no shortage of psychopaths in position of power.
Mm-hmm.
And they do it because they can. And,
mm-hmm.
And there are other reasons, of course. This is complicated, yes. Gary. Many of these people were abused themselves. Many of them do have power issues. I mean, we could go on and on. I mean, that's a very long conversation.
Yes.
But basically, they do it because they can.
And that's a very sad state to the amount of people that are damaged for the rest of their lives, especially children. That's what's most heartbreaking, is these kids for the rest of their lives are going to be traumatized by that particular event that happened at such a foundational age with them.
Mm-hmm. And then they get into support groups and recovery programs with others who've been abused in the same way. Then they're in a trauma bond, and then we have another layer of trauma to resolve.
Do you find there's enough support in the psychotherapy community to handle? I mean, it seems so pervasive throughout we're just talking about American society, but I mean, globally, is there enough of a support system, psychological and otherwise, to help these people?
No. I mean, you have to remember, we're looking at Western psychotherapeutic theory and practice, which is not respected planet-wide. And there are a number of reasons for this. In some countries, the shaman has more power. And in many of these countries, the religion is the dominant healing force. And who in many of these countries has the time and the money to find a one-on-one therapist? And, there just are not enough therapists to go around. And in many countries, they don't want them anyway. This is why in my first book, Relative Balance in an Unstable World, what we were looking at in the pilot program was scrapping all psychological language and working with nature as the healer in resolving the trauma with the combat and with the sexual abuse. And I tell you, it works. And we did not use any psychological theory or language.
Mm-hmm.
Because this model works worldwide, because nature's everywhere.
Right, exactly. And it wouldn't have any, unless someone was anti-pagan and knew about paganism, it wouldn't have any charge for people.
It's not called paganism worldwide.
Right.
These are the nature-based religions. And in most of the world, they have more influence than Western psychotherapy. I mean, this was an enormous challenge for me when I went to work in Russia, because they had no respect whatsoever for psychology. And they have no psychological language in Russian, because Stalin banned psychology from the Russian language in the 1930s. So, here I was, American, talking, psychological, this, that, and the other thing, and they said, "I'm sorry, we can't translate this. We don't have this in our language." And, once I got over the shock of that, it was refreshing, actually, to use words that were not tangled up with Western psychological theory, because that's not the only route to healing. Nature also works. You don't need one. You don't need one therapist and one client. That's a Western bias.
And interestingly, in Russia, there seems to be such a surge of alcoholism. that seems to be rampant in their whole culture is that one way they're reacting to trauma bonds of their own nation, because there's been plenty of purges long before Adolf Hitler came along. You have plenty of purges of Jews in Russia and the Bolshevik Revolution and everything that happened there. So do you feel like the Russian people themselves collectively are in a trauma bond, hence the alcoholism might be a reaction to that, where there's no other support system to walk them through that?
Well, that's a very complicated question. You know, if you study Russian history, it's been revolving door trauma since Peter the Great. Every generation. And, you know, the truth is, Stalin murdered 30 million of his own people. I mean, you hear about Hitler's 6 million. How about Stalin's 30 million? And
he
turned on his own people. Talk about betrayal. So, you know, multi-generational trauma in Russia. And I was there in the 90s, and there were no psychotropic drugs. There was no psychotherapy. There was the only thing they had was marijuana and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
It's, from what I understand, it's very different now. The alcoholism problem is being addressed. But I haven't been there for a while, so I really can't comment on what's going on there recently. But, you know, just look at their history. Overwhelming life events. And, you know, the terror under Stalin was very different from the Nazi terror. You know, the Nazis used to drag people out into the street and make examples of them, right, in very sadistic ways.
Mm-hmm.
Russian terror under Stalin was, you know, these black cars would come in the middle of the night, people would disappear, and they were never mentioned, and all record that they ever existed was destroyed.
Wow.
It's a different kind. And so the coping mechanism was different, which is you don't want information.
Mm-hmm.
Because information is dangerous. So, you know, their social trauma has a different quality than, you know, you saw under the Nazis and so on. It's complicated.
Absolutely. Yes, well, we have a couple of minutes left, and we had a couple other questions. We've been speaking a lot about trauma, but one of the questions, how would the average person know if they're involved in a trauma bond? We only have a couple minutes left, so I know we could go on for hours here.
The trauma bond, people need to ask themselves if they're willing, and maybe they're not, and we have to respect that, Gary.
Mm-hmm.
What is the basis for our connection? Are we connecting around our pain, our wounds, our humiliations, our frustrations? Or are we connecting around something else? Are we bonding from our weakness rather than our strength?
Mm-hmm.
Does our bond depend upon our mutual pain?
Very interesting. And have you found, like, we have about a minute left here, and I will type your contact information on the live link in about a half hour when it becomes live. But is there hope, so we can leave with our listeners, there is hope that trauma bonds can be resolved?
First of all, they have to recognize that there is such a thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that it's not something about destiny or soulmates or anything like that, that it's about something else. And if they're willing to face that, then the next step is, well, now they have a choice, and the choice comes from awareness. What is our connection based upon? Is it based upon strength or weakness?
Mm, excellent.
And it's a choice.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. This happened just by so fast. This is Gary Stewart of Conscious Connection on Blog Talk Radio. My guest today was Angwin St. Just. She's a PhD, and she has many books out, which I will put on our live link to this discussion, and her contact information as well, if people would like to contact her. And I can't thank you enough for this, Angwin. It's just been wonderful to speak about this, and it's an endless topic. We could have 20 shows on with what's going on in the world. Of you taking the time here to alert our listeners on the effects of trauma in their lives, and that there is hope. I want to end on a positive note, that there is hope, that we can address it and get help with it, so we're not victims of it for our whole existence.
There's hope and there's choice.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. And namaste. And this is Gary Stewart of Conscious Connection with Angwin St. Just.